I'm back. And you can tell me your other two wishes after the service. If you need some suggestions, I wish you never left, or I wish you could be up there every week. We'll both work. So I'm excited to be back, but it's hard for me to decide when I kind of come up here at the beginning of a new series. It's like, what do I want to start today that I'm going to finish 3 years from now? So it's a tough call, but I really shouldn't complain about how seldom I'm on the schedule, Mark, because I fully admit I break a lot of rules of preaching. I think we talked about one last week. We talked about the three-point sermon, right? Sermons are supposed to have 3 points. I always have one. I hope at the end you remember one thing, my main point, but they're supposed to have three. Last week, Mark tried to get six past us. Did you notice that? Yeah, I wasn't having that. I stopped listening after the first three. Design, definition, desire, then the earbuds went in. I don't know, because you're not getting six. That's not allowed. But that's kind of a rule of, if you want to be invited back to guest speak, you probably shouldn't make fun of the person who invites you. And I just kind of was going through the catalog of things I've done. And I was thinking to myself, you know, this was my tribute to cats. I found out that Mark hates cats. So at the beginning of my sermon that week, we did a tribute to cats. And, you know, that was the first time I ever spoke, actually. I used that one. And, you know, my failed line of clothing, my Pastor Punk clothing line, which I tried to get off the ground, didn't kind of work. So I kind of get it. You know, those are things you shouldn't do if you want to be a regular guest speaker. There's also the time when Mark was on vacation that I tried to convince you all to text him that the church was on fire, and some of you did it. Do you remember this slide? I had said, let's say hi to Mark. He's on vacation. I put this up. This is about 6 years ago now. And somebody actually texted him, seriously, there are only two fire extinguishers in the whole church. I think he was on a cruise, but, you know, probably shouldn't do stuff like that. There was a time I got booed. Do you remember that? That's a while back. The entire back corner booed me because I was making fun of Dunville. And so the next week was, what do they call it? Dirt Cat Festival? What do they call it? Whatever they call it, with the fish thing down in Dunville. So I went down there to Dunville with my sign to make amends. And I'm just like, you know what? Maybe I'm on the schedule more than I deserve. But I sometimes think, you know what? A lot of times we break rules because just there's so many rules. Right? There's so many rules about everything that we do. There's a rule, and sometimes we break them because we just get tired of knowing what they are. And I think about that. We have rules, like even just informal rules, in our personal lives too. Like, for example, in marriage. Most people who are married kind of have some rules, some guidelines. Candace and I have been married 30 years, and we just have one simple rule. Two wrongs don't make a right. But three wrongs, and I'm sleeping on the couch. And that's served us well for all of these years. Parenting is always real simple, eye for an eye, right? Like, think about it. Have you ever sat down with one of your kids and asked, why did you do that to your brother? Why did you set his hair on fire? Why did you put him headfirst in the toilet? Why did you do these things? And the answer is always, well, he started it, right? Eye for an eye. There's rules at work, at school, at church, in small group. When we pray, we all follow some unwritten rules, right? Eyes closed, heads down, no peeking. Is that what you do? I don't know. I'm not peeking, so I don't know. But that's everybody just in unison. You say we're going to pray, and it's just like it's not a rule, but it's kind of a rule, right? I was golfing recently, and the guy comes over in the cart. The marshal comes over and says, "You really should try to stay on your own fairway." Well, I am trying to stay on my own fairway. I'm not doing it on purpose, but it's a rule, right? But you shouldn't be over here. It's not your fairway. And it's just, you know, we can further confuse things because we just have rules piled on top of rules. And then we're told there's some rules that you don't really have to follow, but some you definitely have to follow. And then it gets really confusing because sometimes you watch the news and you think, there are no more rules. Like, it just seems like everything just happens and nobody even attempts to change things. And I think the best example of that would be a bylaw. And so I was reading Hamilton, for example. Hamilton became a city in 1846. And over the years, they've developed 525 bylaws. Not in total, just to do with city parks. If you go to a city park in Hamilton, there are 525 rules in effect. And year after year, they keep adding them, and nobody ever goes back and takes any of them away. So I got a few written down here. Number one, I thought was interesting. You cannot remove boulders from a Hamilton city park. That's a $200 fine. I would suggest you a boulder costs a lot more than $200, so maybe it's worth it. But Keeping livestock in a city park, that's a $100 fine. If you want to land a helicopter in a city park, you may not. That's a $200 fine. Releasing balloons, that's allowed, but only 9 every 24 hours. I'm not making this up. That's a $75 fine if you let that 10th one off, or if you get there after 23 and a half hours, $75 fine. This is my favorite. I thought it was fake at first, but I actually found it in a newspaper article in the Hamilton Spectator. It is against a bylaw to kill or otherwise disturb a worm. $75. Now, I kind of assume, you know, that there was some meaning behind all of this, right? There's probably a reason they did this, but they're a little hard to understand. I mean, what is it about that 10th balloon that just kind of puts you into the category of criminal? And when you look at all 525 of these bylaws, you realize at some point that maybe they've lost focus. Maybe they've forgotten what they're trying to do and what they're trying to accomplish. Because the idea of a park was not to be somewhere where bylaw enforcement could get their quota of tickets. It was meant to be a great place for people and families to spend time together outdoors. And so it's not that any of these are wrong. I don't want to go to the park and have to step around cow patties. I don't want to, you know, be disturbed at my picnic by a crane picking up a boulder. And I certainly don't want to see people torturing and murdering worms. Like, it's just, I'm not interested in that. But it seems as though maybe we've gotten away from the true intention, that we could just go to the park and everybody could kind of get along and do their own thing. And so we do that. We as people, we tend to complicate things. 525 things you need to know before you leave your house and start walking towards that park. But if I can be honest with you, the Bible has a lot of rules too. And it's this thing we call the Bible, you know, it's a collection of documents from thousands of years written by many, many different people, changed into hundreds of different translations. And I was amazed to find this out this week, that over 4.2 billion copies of the Bible have ever been produced. 4.2 billion. To be a bestseller, you need to sell 5,000 copies. So this has been a bestseller 1 million times over. It's an amazing, amazing document. But it's a lot of stuff in here. And a lot of it, when you read it, it sounds like it's a lot of rules. And if you actually go through the Old Testament, just the Old Testament, you will find 613 different rules for living. And we can't know them all, of course, but I bet we know some of them. We probably know 10 of them, right? We probably know the 10 commandments. Do you guys know them? Yeah, the optimism is overwhelming. Let's hear them. What are some of the Ten Commandments? Call them out. Put no other gods before me. Number one. No murder. That's a good one. What else? Except for worms.
Don't lie, don't steal, honor your parents.
There's three more. That's five.
Don't commit adultery.
Yeah, six. Coveting, yeah. Don't covet your neighbor's stuff. There's a whole list that your neighbor has. You can't have it, right? Keeping the Sabbath holy, right? Can't remember if we missed one more. Did we do father and mother? There you are. We can come up with a 10, right? And I bet if we really tried, we could come up with some more. But I don't know, do we have time to do all 603? You just call them out and I'll just point? Probably not, right? At some point, we look at these lists and we just think, they're really, really long lists. So if you look at the 10 commandments here, I just want you to notice something. I want you to notice that the first four tend to be focused on our relationship with God. And the last six tend to be focused on our relationship with other people. And so that's an important concept. As we go forward, I want you to keep that in mind, that there's this kind of dichotomy. There's two parts almost to it. And so I really don't think it's surprising that one day somebody came up to Jesus and just said, man, that's a lot of rules. Which ones are really important? In fact, which one is the greatest of all time? And when asked that question, Jesus chose to simplify. I know that Jesus could have recited 613, but he chose to simplify. And we're gonna pick it up right here. It's in Mark 12. We're going to actually look at this story in two different Gospels. But if you want to find Mark, towards the back, you get into the red letter section of your Bible. Just look around in that first part of there. But it says this in Mark 12, starting in verse 28. One of the teachers of the law came and heard them debating. Noticing that Jesus had given them a good answer, he asked him, of all the commandments, which is the most important? And it's probably worth mentioning that this person who asked the question wasn't really looking for an answer. They were looking for trouble, right? They were trying to catch Jesus that he might say something wrong. And so instantly, Jesus knows how to answer. He simply says this, the most important one, verse 29, answered Jesus, is this. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one.
Verse 30, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. The second is this, love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these. Well said, teacher, the man replied. You are right in saying that God is one and there is no one other than him. To love him with all your heart, with all your understanding, with all your strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself is more important than all burnt offerings and sacrifices. When Jesus saw that he had answered wisely, he said to him, you're not far from the kingdom of God. And from then on, no one dared ask him any more questions. Well, that's a teacher's dream right there. An answer so good, there's no follow-up questions. They didn't have anything else to say. But he asked him, what's the most important rule? And Jesus gave him two. And what Jesus is really saying here at the end of that section is that, you know, this guy gets it. This guy understands that it's not really about the number of rules you keep. It's something much, much bigger. It's about how you love God and how you love people. And so burnt sacrifices and the Ten Commandments and the 613 instructions were all ways that you could measure your relationship with God in the Old Testament. But in the New Testament, there seems to be a brand new way of measuring the health and maturity of your relationship with him. And it's found all throughout the New Testament. So let's take a look. We'll kind of go through them fairly quickly. First one is Matthew 5. Matthew 5 says this, starting in verse 23. Therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to them. Then come and offer your gift. Sacrifice is good, I would say, but a right heart is better. 1 John 2, starting in verse 7. Dear friends, I am not writing you a new command, but an old one, which you have had since the beginning. This old command is the message you have heard. So John says, I'm going to give you an old command. And then he says this in verse 8, yet I'm writing you a new command. It's a new way of stating it. It is a new way of organizing all those 613. And he says this, yet I'm writing you a new command. Its truth is seen in him and in you because the darkness is passing and the true light is already shining. Anyone who claims to be in the light but hates a brother or sister is still in the darkness. Anyone who loves their brother and sister lives in the light, and there is nothing in them to make them stumble. But anyone who hates a brother or sister is in the darkness and walks around in the darkness. They do not know where they are going because the darkness has blinded them. Well, that word hates is a strong word, so I went to look it up. I looked it up in the Greek lexicon. I looked it up all the way back into the Hebrew. Here's what the word hate means. It means hate. It means the same today as it did back then. To detest, to despise, to hold ill will toward, to stand or oppose someone. And here when it says brother and sister, it's talking about other believers. The Greek word says this is the relationship that we're talking about here. So he says, anyone who claims to be in the light but hates another believer is still in the darkness. Finally, this one, John 13, verse 34 and 35. A new command I give you, love one another as I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another. Now, if you think about it, shouldn't it say, listen, everybody will know you are my disciples if you drive to Balmoral every Saturday night? Isn't that how people would recognize you as believers? Because you come here, and you're parked out there, and you're sitting in here. Or maybe it's, you know, they will know you're my disciples because you give to the church, you support the church. They'll know you are my disciples because you volunteer downstairs with the kids. They'll know you're my disciple. Maybe you join a Bible study. And that's not what it says, though. It doesn't say that at all. What it says is they will know you are my disciples if you love one another. And disciple simply means follower, a follower of Jesus. And he says the way that they will know that is by how you treat each other. So let's go back to that same conversation we just heard about in the book of Mark. Let's go to Matthew 22, and we're going to hear the same conversation recorded from a different pair of eyes. Matthew was there, so Matthew would have written this based on what he saw that day, and it's almost spot on. It says, hearing that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees and Pharisees, the Pharisees got together. One of them, an expert in the law, tested him with this question, teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law? Jesus replied, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. It says, all the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. All 613 can be filed into one of these two categories, loving God, loving God's people. So if I were a Sadducee or a Pharisee back in the day, I probably would have wondered to myself, well, why did he give me two? I asked for one, he gave me two, but I don't think it's accidental. Jesus chose to put these two ideas together. And although he was only asked for what's the number one, he said, I can't give you one, I have to give you both. And it's this key idea that, remember John said, you know, it's a new commandment, but it's actually an old commandment, because these two commandments fit in perfectly with what we saw in the Old Testament, what we saw in that list of 10 commandments either, loving God, how we live and love others in our community. And this is the key idea that kind of comes back over and over again. Love the God all with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind is straight from the book of Deuteronomy. He's quoting the Old Testament there. And love your neighbor as yourself comes from Leviticus. And we're going to look at those in a few minutes here. But we just see it over and over again in the New Testament. It's a simple concept and simply this. You can't be right with God and not be right with God's people. You can't be right with God and not be right with God's people. You can't be in love with your Heavenly Father and be at war with his children. Romans 13, starting in verse 8, says this, let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another, for whoever loves others has fulfilled the law. The commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and whatever other command there may be, are summed up in this one command, love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. The Old Testament laws have not gone away, but they are fulfilled by these two. That you don't need to know 613 anymore, because anything that you're instructed to do in the Old Testament would fall into these one of these two categories. And so if you believe in the Bible, you believe what Jesus is teaching, you realize you can't get by with just loving God. There's an admonishment here to love his people. So before you can measure relationship with God through the law, through the Ten Commandments, through the 613 rules, that's how you can measure yourself up. But now we don't need to. Now we simply have these two ideas that we can look at. And we can't separate the two. I don't believe that. I can't have a great relationship with God and yet have a terrible relationship with his people. Because you can't be right with God and not be right with God's people. And these two commands that Jesus gave us, they're just like the Ten Commandments, where they're focused on God, but they're also focused on God's people. And here's the important concept is just simply this. If you have you know, a check mark in one column, you have to have a check mark in the other column. You can't be good at one and terrible at the other. We're called to do these things together. And so think about how God has forgiven, accepted, included you, and realize that in that same lens, this is how we should deal with other people in our lives. A Christian who claims godly behavior yet cannot forgive, accept, and include others is someone who has never really understood the relationship between themselves and God. Because as long as you measure a relationship based on performance, you're going to have so many reasons to hold other people away and to simply say, they're not there. I reject you. I can't forgive you. I have a grudge against you because you're holding them to a standard that God doesn't hold you. So let me ask you this. Do you want God to view his relationship with you based on your performance? I would answer a hearty no, I don't. Jesus' most simple practical message that he shared was simply this, people will know that you are with me based on how you treat them. You can't be right with God and not be right with God's people. So I wanna end today. I'm not ending, just to put that out there right now. I want to end today just looking at a passage from Ephesians. I just want to kind of see what this looks like in real life, because sometimes these things kind of feel a little cliche. We just kind of say, of course, yeah, love God, love people. I think it's our slogan out front of our sign still says that, loving God, loving people. But I think we have to really kind of dig in a little bit and see what does this look like. And there's something you need to know about the culture in which we're dealing with here. So this is Roman culture, this is Jewish culture, and they had kind of two things in common. Or one thing in particular in common, and it's simply this, that religious people, both figuratively and literally, were seen as being apart from the regular people. And so if you think about even something like, the idea of being unclean. So if you were an important enough member of the religious elite, there were people you couldn't even go near, people you couldn't touch. You think about even things like, monks hidden away in monasteries or nuns living in a convent, like separated because that was their dedication to God. And so Bobibo would use this idea that if you were truly holy, you would separate yourself from other people, and they used it to their own advantage. And it comes around this word dedication. And so it's this idea that people would dedicate everything they own to God, which sounds great. But they would still have the stuff. They would still use the stuff. But if you came to me and said, "Can you help me? I'm in need," they would say, "I can't. This isn't mine. It belongs to the Lord." It's a little bit like if I dedicated my car to God. I still drive it. I still use it. But if you ever want to borrow it, I'd simply say to you, "Listen, sorry, it belongs to God. Maybe you can ask him." And so people would do this. They would use the idea of dedicating something to God as a way of kind of separating themselves from other people. And it was such a common thing in this culture that we actually see the language change over time. And this is a very interesting word. And I think we have time for a little moment to take a peek at the Greek. There it is. Oh, yeah. All right. It goes on forever. You'll have to turn it on. No, don't. Okay, that's all right. Leave that up there. I need a volunteer. Volunteer who doesn't mind coming up here and perhaps looking foolish. Isaac. Oh, valedictorian. He's gonna kill this. That's going to be boring. Isaac, come on up. Isaac, have you seen Peek at the Greek before? Maybe online, streaming at school, like probably somewhere, right? Yeah, so if you haven't seen it, we're simply putting up a clue here on how we're going to pronounce this Greek word. The Greek word is written at the bottom, and I've got four very helpful hints. I'm assuming you watch Little House on the Prairie on a regular basis. Yeah, so you know the last one. So do you want any help with any of these? Do you think you know what they mean? This lady here? Guys, who's this?
Ma.
Ma, that's Ma Ingalls. Here's the thing about Little House on the Prairie. You can stop recording for a minute. I used to hate that show so much because I had two sisters, and every day after school, they outvoted me, or in some cases, outpunched me, and they would get the TV, and you know, back in the olden days, you had one TV in your house, not several. I didn't have a cell phone, so I had to watch Little House on the Prairie because that's what they put on, and I hated that show so much, but I can tell you right now, I can tell you the storyline of at least 20 different episodes from the top of my head. Remember the time Nellie got in trouble at school?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you remember the time at the store when Ma was selling eggs and the Olsen dad yelled at the Olsen mom for the first time? That was crazy. Remember the older sister went blind?
Yes.
Oh, it's tough. Tough. Great show. Great show. I highly recommend it. But I hate it. So that's Ma. That's Ma in the end. Due to your age, I'll give you that one. What do you think? Well, what would his pronoun be? Oh, I give you. He. So we got Hema at the end. That's a gnat. Guys, there's only so much I can do. I can't change the Greek word. It is what it is. Oh. They turn it off. Anathema?
Uh-huh.
Is that what you're claiming?
Yeah.
Wow. Don't leave without your valuable prize. I was going to get your Rice-A-Roni, but they don't make it anymore. So thank you, Isaac. Big round of applause for Isaac. Anathema. Anathema. Anybody know the definition? That'd be really impressive. I did not. I looked it up. It's an interesting word. It's a word that just means set apart or dedicated. And so all throughout time, that's what that word meant. But the culture was so strong and so corrupt that after, it always used to be meant as set aside for God as a sacrifice. But the root word is set aside. And over time, the language actually changed. And that's something that happens. Definitions of words kind of change over time. For example, cool used to be a temperature. Now I'm the definition of cool. I don't know how that happened, but it just happened. Right? Definitions change over time. And so the original definition of set aside for God as a sacrifice over time changed to set aside as hated or detested. The definition changed completely. It's actually the root word from where we get the concept of excommunication. If you think about being kicked out of a church, it's like being set aside in a bad way. And what's so interesting about this is that it's in this cultural context that Paul is writing. And so what Paul's saying here, he's pushing back against this idea that, you know, you can dedicate things for God so that you can keep it for yourself, that you can have this word anathema. You can have this concept, and it just, I'm going to say it one more time now. It's just this idea that it's just like, it's changed. It used to be such a pure and wholesome thing to dedicate something to God. And over time, because of the way it was used, it now meant to be set aside for destruction. And so that's the world that they're living in. And what's really interesting is if you're here when Gus was here a few weeks ago, he, out of the blue, taught us the Hebrew word for dedication. Anybody remember it? I'll say it how he said it. Haram. Haram. That's the exact same word in Hebrew. When he said that, I couldn't believe it. I was like, he's doing my sermon. I'm going to go up there and stop him. Like he's, it's the same word. And that's the context Paul's writing into. Paul's not just kind of sharing thoughts off the top of his head. This is the difficulty he's seeing in the Ephesian church. People who are setting things aside for God, but really they're setting things aside for their own selfishness. And so we're going to read the first three verses of Ephesians 4. And this is Paul writing. He says this, "As a prisoner for the Lord, then, I urge you to live a life worthy of the calling you have received. Be completely humble and gentle, be patient, bearing with one another, make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit through the bond of peace." And that expression, worthy of the calling, it actually means an invitation. It's not a birthright. It doesn't mean because you were born into this family, that means you're Jewish, or you're born in this family, and that means you're Roman. He's not talking about a birthright. He's talking about an invitation that you can accept. He's saying that worthy of the calling that you as believers have accepted. And it means that if you choose to accept this invitation to do life with God, you're finding that there are some expectations according to that column. And here's some of them that Paul shares. And the first thing I want you to notice is that everything on here is relational. It doesn't say, pray in a way that is worthy of your calling, give in a way that is worthy of your calling, attend church in a way that is worthy of your calling, or sing out loud in a way that is worthy of your calling. Those are all great things, but I would argue those are not God things. Those are relational things. Not saying that God doesn't value those things, of course, but these things that Paul writes, humble, gentle, patient, and bearing with one another in love, these are relational things. And it's clear if we have these two commandments from Jesus and he gives us these two, the list from Paul goes this way, love one another, that's the first thing. And these are three examples of how you can actually do that. What would it look like in your life? Because the word love is kind of hard to define sometimes. You say love one another, what does that mean? Well, it would mean being humble. It would mean being gentle. It would mean being patient. So let's take a look at a few of those words real quick. Let's look at the first one, humble. And I don't mind telling you, I'm the best at being humble. You guys don't even come close. I'm very good at being humble. But simply ask you this, did God humble himself? Did Jesus humble himself? He sure did. He humbled himself in a way where if we are tempted to say, well, look at that person, God would look at us and say, I'm looking at you. I'm not looking at that person. I'm looking at you. Gentle. It's such a soft-spoken word. I feel like I need to kind of whisper it when I say it. You know, it's gentle. It's very gentle. I'm too manly for this word. I don't like this word. So I looked it up. What's going on with you? Imagine you're getting... I said I'm too manly for that word. Yeah, every time. but imagine you're at work and you're going in for your performance appraisal. And you're heading in, and maybe you work in the ovens at Stelco, maybe you're a roofer, you're working a construction crew, your boss sits you down, he says, you know, I'm really happy with your work this year. I asked all the guys on the crew how they would best describe you, and they all said, without exception, he's so gentle. Like, I don't know what that word means. It seems out of place, so I kind of looked it up, and really what it means is self-control, and I like that much, much better. I always think the way Andy Stanley defines self-control, he says, when you get fired up, you choose to gear down. The difference with self-controlled instead of gentle is this, that with self-controlled, it gives this image of you have the ability, you have the strength, you have the might to force your will onto a situation, but you choose not to. And that's what gentle means here. It's kind of like, you know, instead of putting gentle on your resume, you should just put down like won't crack under pressure, something like that. This idea that not that you're powerless, but that you hold back the power that you have in reference to someone else. But again, it's relational. You to other people. It's not that you need to be self-controlled in your relationship with God because you have no control over God. You have no control over God. You can't impose your will on God, even if sometimes we try. And that leads right into patience. The ability and willingness to take a step back and wait. And I ask you this, has God ever been patient with you? And if the answer is yes, aren't you glad he was? And how many times did he need to be? And it's not that you deserved it, not because this is how God, it's not because you deserved it, but because this is how God chooses to treat you. And it may sound like a cliche, but don't gloss over this. The patience of God needs to be reflected in our patience with God's people. I didn't realize I was going to do so much advertising for television tonight. Anybody see the show, Everybody Loves Raymond? That might be my favorite show. I love that show. And there's a really funny story where Ray is going to an awards banquet, Sports Writer of the Year, something like that. I don't remember exactly. And he's giving his wife a hard time the day before. You can't be late. You can't make me late. I have to be there on time. And she says, fine, I'll be ready. And then, of course, Ray takes some advice from Robert and his friends, and they say to him, listen, if she's not ready on time, just leave. She'll learn. Just leave. She'll learn. Well, of course, he does, and we find out later when he comes home and she comes downstairs with a curling iron stuck in her hair because she couldn't get it out, that there had been a pretty good reason why she was running late. But he didn't even want to know. He just decided, I'm leaving without her. And it's kind of a silly example, but I don't want you to miss the point. When you think about your attitude towards your wife, your kids, your husband, your friends, your relationships, and you ask yourself, you know, how long did God wait on me? How long would it take for God to honk the horn in frustration because I wasn't ready on time? And how long would it take for him to drive away in frustration, leaving me behind? And I think we know the answer, that there is no length of time that would fit. But how long do I extend that courtesy to the people around me, the people I love around me? And I know you can't compare the scale of being late for a dinner with some of the hurts and struggles you have in your life. And I'm not saying that those struggles and hurts are not real and not legitimate, but it's kind of the point. You also can't compare your ability to be humble and gentle and self-controlled with God's. And some of you might be thinking, yeah, but you don't know the people in my life. And sometimes it feels easier to hold a grudge than to address it. But I want to show you something from the Old Testament. And this is where we got the expression, love your neighbor as yourself. That wasn't written as its own book, its own chapter, even its own verse. So let's just take a look at the rest of that verse. It's Leviticus 19, verse 17 and 18. It says this, do not nurse hatred in your heart for any of your relatives. Confront people directly so you will not be held guilty for their sin. Do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against a fellow Israelite, but love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. That's what Jesus was quoting in that moment. And then if you have your Bible open to Leviticus 19, I'm just going to say if you have kids next, you just close it up. It gets weird after that. But Leviticus 19, verse 17 and 18 is where that comes from. Do not seek revenge or bear a grudge. And it kind of makes me think back to my middle school bully, Troy. Anybody here named Troy? Because I'll wait while you leave. Is there? No? All right, Troy, if you're watching online. So here, you know, I don't know about you, but you know, I certainly had plenty of reason to be picked on by Troy because I was mouthier then than now. And I know that's hard to believe. But I grew up with the last name Watson, which means I heard thousands of Sherlock Holmes jokes, thousands of them. Would you like to hear one?
Yes.
You would. No. I wasn't actually going to wait for you to answer. You're hearing one. Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson go camping. I say Dr. Watson because he earned that title. They pitch their tent under the stars and they go to sleep. And sometime in the middle of the night, Holmes wakes up Watson. He says, Watson, look up at all those stars and tell me what you see. Dr. Watson. He says, you know, I see millions of stars organized into galaxies, each with a planet and moons rotating around them in perfect harmony. So I deduce that there is a God. There is a creator who has brought life from nothing, created the universe with a simple word from his mouth. To which Holmes replied, "Snow Watson, you dolt. That means someone's stolen our tent." Now, that joke is a little sophisticated for Troy. He was more of a, "Hey, Dr. Watson, arm behind the back, facing a snowbank" sort of guy. But, you know, we have people that we hold something back sometimes. We have grudges. We have people who have mistreated us. And we get to choose how we respond to those situations. So let me just ask you this. What would happen if you remove the focus from the person and put the focus on God? Now, I'm not saying you take your anger, your frustration, and your grudge and give that to God, but you focus your life on God. It's not always easy to know this because sometimes, you know, people make it difficult. Sometimes people just make it really, really hard to show them love. And sometimes it makes them really, really hard to accept kind of what they're doing and how it influences us. I'm killing time till the cartoon goes up. I don't know if you could tell there. Here we go. There we go. You guys can read that while I carry on here. But you don't lose focus on the simple fact that you can't be right with God and not be right with God's people. And so if we go back to Ephesians 4 real quick, it ends with this: keep the unity through the bond of peace. And this word here, keep, simply means guard or preserve. Be on your guard. Stay vigilant to keep your relationships pure. And when we lose sight of what God has done for us, that's when we get into trouble relationally. I'm going to do unto you as God has done unto me. That's a new standard. And it's not based on a list of thou shalls and thou shall nots. It's not a restating of the Ten Commandments or the 613 Old Testament laws. It's a new standard. And in that standard, your attitude matters. It kind of reminds me, I'm not sure how many years ago it was, but Candace and I won a free trip to Tahiti. Yeah, private jet, which made me really, really angry because I wanted to collect air miles, and they said I couldn't. They said, "The private jet, you can't collect air miles, and it's free, so you can't." I was furious. I was fuming the entire way over. They had a beautiful open bar, but I don't really drink. Prime rib was a little overdone, to be honest, and it's just like the whole time I'm on that plane, I'm just like, This is the worst trip ever. I was just furious. And then we get to the hotel room, and it was ocean view, but I've already seen the ocean. I wanted to be on the city side. And I told them that. I said, "I'd rather be on the city side." And they said, "We're sorry. We only have one presidential suite, and you're going to have to stay on the ocean side." And what was it? It must have been a three-hour wait for the free scuba diving lessons. And it was two full weeks, and I was bored after 12 days, and it's just a terrible experience all around. And as we flew home, I was like so angry that I'd entered that contest and won that free trip. And for some reason, Candace really enjoyed it. I guess her standards are lower than mine. I don't know. She thought it was great because your attitude matters, right? When I think of what Jesus has done for me and my salvation, how he humbled himself, I think, yeah, you know what? I can be more humble. When I think of what Jesus has done for me and my sanctification, the gentle use of correction on me over the years, I think to myself, you know what? Yeah, I can show some more self-control. And when I think of what Jesus has done for me throughout eternity and that I will spend eternity with him, I think to myself, you know what? I think I can be more patient, because you can't be right with God and not be right with God's people. And so we don't have to ask or wonder what is the greatest commandment of all time. Jesus simply told us. But it's not one, it's two. It's for us to say we're going to love God with all of our heart, with all of our soul, with all of our strength, but we're going to love each other as well. And so I think it's a healthy thing from time to time to take stock or measure yourself as far as your relationships are concerned. And that's true whether we're talking about your relationship with other people or your relationship with God. And I think as we go through this series, we're going to kind of start to pick on some of these ideas about this relationship with others, and look at forgiveness, and look at acceptance, and look at serving and encouraging and submitting to others as a way of understanding not just that this is how we've been called to act towards each other, but this is how God has chosen to act with us in our lives. And so now I remind you to measure yourself, not to measure others, because in the end, you can't be right with God and not be right with God's people. Why don't we pray? Lord, just want to thank you. I want to thank you for an opportunity to share. I want to thank you for your word. It's so rich. You can read the same section of your scripture, Lord, and learn something new from it every time, Lord. And I just know that this has hit me so hard, this idea that you can't separate the two, and that our love for you must be shown in our love for others. And I thank you for that. I thank you for your unending love for me and for everyone here, Lord, that you have no limit to how much you love us, how much you care for us, and how much you look out for us, Lord. But would we be a people who would actively seek to treat others in the same way? And we just thank you so much, Jesus. Amen. Well, I have some discussion questions. I don't know if you guys do these or not. I won't ask for a show of hands, but we always just kind of want to have some stuff. When you hear a sermon, it's usually great, especially with one point. You should be able to remember it, but we always find that if you talk about it with somebody, even just in a cursory way, it locks in a lot of more of what you may have just heard. So if you're willing, there's some questions here. I won't read through them with you, but you can kind of just go through these. But I do mean question five, seriously. Is there something that Kingsway can do to help? Is there something? Is there a relationship in your life you would like to receive some advice, some help, some counseling? Are there things in your life that you feel are holding you back? Because if your relationships are being held back with other people, that's going to affect your relationship with him as well. So if there's anything you would like help with or just like to talk about, always myself. Zach's usually here. Mark, we're always happy to talk to you. But you don't need somebody who stands on the stage to do it. You just need to talk to other believers and hear their story and understand what's happened in their life so that you can better understand maybe what's happening in yours. I've learned so much from fellow Kingsway people and struggles they've gone through, usually in small groups or in Bible studies. As Mark says, you don't often grow in the row. It's hard to chat during a sermon because I'll call you out. You know I will. But it is not hard to chat with people after. So there's no rush. It's not Sunday morning. There's no, there's room to move. There's snacks in the back. There's coffee. So we invite you to stick around. If you have kids downstairs, good for you. Go get them. And we'll see you next week.